Hello, Internet world. Welcome to Country Style Comics. My name is Andrew Bowman. I'll be your host. To my right is Isaac, also known as Possum.
Hello.
To my left, we've got Dusty. We sometimes call him D.
How you doing?
All right, so what we want to do is we want to discuss everything and anything related to comic books, related to heroes, related to anybody you may have wanted to grow up to be who wore a cape when you were five. So, well, the first thing we did this week...
Some of us still wear a cape.
Yeah, some
just
of us
wanted to say.
Still wear a cape. For more information on that, see Dusty's Facebook page and his wedding pictures. We watched a movie, X-Men First Class, came out in 2010. So it was obviously a movie I think that we had... that all of us had watched before now. This wasn't anybody's first time watching First Class, was it?
I don't think.
Yeah, so we'd all seen it before. Just, man, you can never watch a good movie, an X-Men movie, too many times. This is, of course, starring starring James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, Jennifer Lawrence, Kevin Bacon, and directed by Matthew Vaughn. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting about it, that I thought was really cool, I'm more of a DC guy naturally, more of a Superman guy naturally, and one of the things that I thought was interesting compared to Superman or Batman or any of those typical pinpoint superhero icons is X-Men seem to be more of a discussion on what's right and wrong as opposed to a standard to measure what somebody, whether somebody is doing right or doing wrong. Superman's always kind of that clean boy image. Spider-Man even somewhat has that image of, okay, this is what a teenager would do if he was given these powers. This is what it would be the right way to do it. X-Men seems to have this discussion with Magneto and Xavier and the whole clan. So what are your guys' thoughts?
Whenever you go back, I tend to think back to my youth whenever I watched the X-Men cartoon that came out in the 90s, and even the comics that I did read and the ones that I bought. And a lot of times, even Stan Lee says that every time you ask him about it, the one thing he likes about X-Men when he wrote it and when he got the idea was that it represented all of humanity. It wasn't designed, it was supposed to be mutants were these quasi-mythical beings that differentiated themselves and were so much better, which is something that's typical in Marvel and even in DC, is you get someone like Superman or someone, even like in Marvel, the Fantastic Four, who are just so above in terms of what's right and wrong, whereas X-Men has the gamut of human personality, human emotions. You've got smart humans or mutants, you've got dumb mutants, you've got mean mutants, you've got nice mutants, you've got some that are scary, some that are fearful. I think that's one of the things that you hit on, and it also goes with that, with the idea of what's right and wrong and morals as well.
One of the biggest things that interests me is, like, they discuss morals quite often as far as through the movie. It's just the way it's laid out, it's like Magneto knows, okay, maybe I shouldn't do this, but he does so for his betterment, for his gain, / survivalism.
You're talking about the fact that he's doing it not only because he wants revenge, but also because he feels like this is gonna, the same thing that happened to the Jews and his,
yeah, it's
like
almost like his obligation because they're being discriminated as mutants. So it's, like I said at the last, it's like a survivalist game in that sense.
The only thing that, and I agree with you, I think that's there, but the thing that the movie didn't do was do a good job because the mutants were just coming out. The newest one just came out, the sequel to this one, and it does a better job of showing how more people are seeing mutants, because up until the end of the movie, nobody knew they existed except for the CIA when Xavier explained it. That was one of the weak points in the movie, and that brings me to another thing that I thought about the movie that really bothered me, was the fact that the mutants seemed more reasonable than humanity, and that's anybody. The only human that seemed the only two humans that seemed reasonable was McTaggart and the guy that took the mutants to his facility, the one that had built Cerebro and everything. And they were the only two that seemed reasonable in terms of the human race. Everybody else just seemed, illogical or even dense.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you could also make the case that the only reason it looks like that necessarily is because this movie focused so heavily on the mutants. I mean, this was an origin story, after all. This wasn't just an X-Men story. It was an origin of the X-Men story. And so, because you could think, I think you could almost make the same case of, well, they're not painting mutants in an even better light because they're focusing highly on Magneto. And in case you think that Magneto's just doing this survival or whatever, I mean, over and over again, the Xavier character kind of challenges him on why he's doing it. Is it good? And I think that it's more of, no, I don't care right or wrong. I care survival. And so, you know, McAvoy's character, or McAvoy's character, comments to him, you know, this won't bring you peace. He's like, peace isn't the option. He's not looking for peace. He's not looking to take the higher ground. He's just looking to take a ground. He just wants something under his feet. And so I think that, especially if you look at, you know, X-Men as a bigger whole than just this movie, I just think it kind of highlights, you know, in this movie, they're not saying, okay, humanity bad, this group good. It was just, they only could show so many humanity characters because it wasn't about humanity so much. They were the backdrop by which the story of these mutants played out.
Well, and I'm not arguing with you. I see what you're saying. But, I mean, I'm just thinking about certain instances in the movie, and it might be just, like you said, the context of the way that it was focused on the mutants, and it was geared towards introducing them. It just seemed like, they picked a particular time in our nation's history, in the world's history, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, where every country was doing something stupid, and nobody knew what the other one was going to do, and it seemed like everybody was, you know, and I think that was probably, maybe that's why they did it, was because they're focusing on the fear being the driving force, and how that contrasts with the fear of mutants, which is about to come whenever they reveal themselves. That's a good point. I think that maybe that's what they were going for. Maybe that's what I didn't see until you mentioned that.
And I think that's kind of the cool thing about X-Men, cool thing about this movie, is that you don't really get to have even this discussion that we're having now with many, if any, other comic book character. With Superman, you don't look at it and go, well, this is how they portray Kryptonians, or this is how they even portray humanity. It's really just kind of this standard, and if you don't see yourself identifying with that standard, you move on. X-Men is a discussion. Okay, are you a Magneto guy? Are you a simple, I just got to make it from birth to death, and whatever I got to do to get there, that's what I'm going to do, which seems to be his mentality? Or are you an Xavier guy, which says birth to death? How do you live that gap in between? What's your dash look like, so to speak? Like, I think that's the cool thing about X-Men, is it gives you that discussion to be had. It's not giving you an answer, whereas I think most of the other comic book characters kind of do.
Fair enough. I feel like you just made me think about when in the movie, it just seemed the mutants were so varied in their personalities and everything. Humans weren't, and maybe it's like you said, they were focusing on the mutants. I think that's the biggest critique I would have, even though I really enjoyed the movie.
Right. Like I was saying, like, I think it's interesting, especially the Magneto character, because he really does ask the question of how far is it okay to go to ensure your survival. And I think you can somewhat debate, especially in this movie, is he doing this really for mutant kind, which is what the overall theme kind of is, or is he doing it for himself? And so I think, you know, you really see this question raised by his character of, how far is it acceptable to go to wipe somebody out? Because I think he somewhat knows going into it that he's going to play. He came out of this really dark, deep time in world history, Holocaust, being a Jew in Germany, in Europe during that time. But at the same time, almost going that direction himself with humans. And so how far do you go to ensure your survival?
That was always one of the things that I thought was interesting about Magneto, is how he had lived through something like that. And you can see how it would turn him into the exact thing that he's trying not to be. But I guess if you think about it, if Jews had a nation at the time to combat the Germans, you know, if Israel existed in the time that the Holocaust happened, would they have bombed Germany? Would they have fought back the way that Magneto is trying to encourage mutants to do? That's a good question.
I think it just goes back to the central point of, hey, I'm hurt. I've been through this discriminatory thing. I've seen the extermination squads. I don't particularly want to go through that again. I think that's what, to me, that's what a lot of it boils down to is he's like, I don't want to see this suffering thing again. Because, like, at the first of the movie when he gets separated from his family, like, that's the whole point of that segment is just complete and utter despair. To me, he just, that's all it is. He just don't want that again.
I think it's not that he doesn't want that. It's he doesn't want that for him or anybody he finds valuable because he's going to see it again. He's just going to be on the other end of it. So it's not like this is necessarily, although I think he would say it is a bad thing, he's not wiping out this idea in general. He's wiping out him being on that end of this idea. He's not getting rid of the rod. He's getting rid of, he doesn't want to be on that end of the rod.
Because he has the upper hand now. He controls the extermination or what have you.
And so, like, I don't know, I just think it's, it begs that question of how far is too far. Not that that's what we're going to land on here or what anything like that, but it's just an interesting question that kind of this movie raises is, because, I mean, everybody agrees that that you fight for something. I mean, there's no civilization in the world. We're fighting for something isn't wrong. It's just, what's that something? And I think that, you know, we live in a world now where...
And how far do you go with that fight?
Absolutely. And how far do you go? I mean, is it to the point of it's okay to have weapons that can destroy the world because that keeps anyone from destroying your half of the world? Like,
or is it worth even hurting someone for? Or I think it's interesting that the two villains, or, you know, I say villains, I shouldn't use that word. The antagonist of the movie, which is Sebastian Shaw. And
which, who didn't love seeing Kevin Bacon again, right?
I loved how he got younger. but they explained that, which I was pleased with. That worked. But the thing that fascinated me was how Sebastian Shaw was doing the exact same thing that Magneto comes to do, but how much animosity Magneto showed for Sebastian.
And I think you can tell it's a very intentional thing. At the end of the day, he puts on his helmet. He puts on Shaw's helmet. Like, that's not an accident. I mean, that's intentional. He is becoming who Shaw was. And you could even make a case of a better, more flashy, more powerful. Because when he comes in and breaks January Jones's character, which I can't think of her name right now, out of the prison at the end, it's not only the same helmet, but he's flashed it up. He's got a whole suit to match. He's painted that sucker this
Emma
nice
Frost
crimson. Yeah, Frost, thank you. Like, he is becoming Shaw, but he's taking it a step further. He just doesn't have a helmet that blocks out all everybody else. His statement is he's taking that out. It's not just something in hiding. So I thought that was kind of a very cool, very interesting.
I didn't think of it that way, but that's you're essentially right. I feel like that's a fair statement. Makes you wonder if Sebastian had not been involved in what happened with Magneto. Or Eric, you know, as a child, would he have joined up with him? I feel like if what happened to Eric hadn't happened, he probably wouldn't feel the way he did. But if you took Sebastian not being the one that directly did it, cause I feel like Eric would have been right there next to him, if not doing it for him or doing it with him, you know.
So are you saying that, like, give him a character to model after? Is that what you mean by that?
Well, I can even go into some psychology with you. You know, it almost is like a, you know, an Oedipus complex of taking out the father, and because the father was a threat. I mean, and he even, whenever they have their discussion right before he kills Shaw, he says, "You made me who I am."
Yeah, yeah.
And he even described himself as Frankenstein's monster looking for his creator. He's looking, even though he hates the guy, he sees him as the way to be.
He doesn't hate him for what he's doing. He literally hates the guy.
Yeah.
He hates, was you who pulled the trigger, who killed my mom. It's not what you're doing, which is what Charles is after. It's, I don't like your mentality. I don't like your philosophy in this. He's like, philosophy, schmosophy, whatever.
Well,
it's literally your DNA that I'm after.
Charles said he agreed. You know, he understood why he felt the way he did. Because he'd saw that. He'd saw his memories whenever he did it.
I see what you're saying with the Shaw idea and him, you know, wanting to be like him while at the same time wanting to destroy him. I wonder if Magneto would have been so ruthless in his quest to see mutants treated fairly if it wasn't for the relationship that he had with Shaw in the beginning, you know, early childhood, how that sculpted him. if he hadn't had someone to model after. Well, almost kind of an abused son becomes an abusive father type of.
That's a good analogy, but I don't. I kind of wonder if he'd still been in the concentration camps and still went through the same stuff he did. I feel like he would still have the same opinions on things, and I think it was just a convenience that everybody that was under Shaw agreed with Magneto and was working because he took everybody with him.
Yeah, and Raven, which was crazy. Like, I mean, granted, we've all seen this before. So, and when you have an origin story, it's kind of hard to have a shocker ending. Everybody knows where the battle lines get drawn and who ends up on what side. But in a very good movie, or in a pretty good movie, I did think it was odd that outside of a couple of lines of Raven dialoguing with Magneto, it was almost just like, all right, I'm picking sides now. It's either Charles or it's me, and it's almost like the director, the writer was like, oh yeah, we got to put Raven on his team. Raven, you walk over there. Like it was just kind of just the most random thing. I'm like, what are you talking? Outside of him almost dropping like 50 pounds of weight on you, what do you got? Like, what is this? I don't understand.
I feel like they started to build it up, but they didn't take enough time to do it.
And it probably would the build up would have probably even been felt more real, more intense. If I felt like she had a stronger relationship with Beast, I felt like if Beast would have said, please don't do that, she'd be like, okay, yeah. Well, like, I just felt like she already had, it wasn't that Magneto was the only tie she had made outside of Xavier to mutant kind. To me, that just seemed weird. It just didn't seem as believable.
Almost like it was Rush.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, absolutely. I almost think that a lot of hers was just because of the discrimination that she had already seen. Like, she was already an outcast because she was blue and scaly. And like none of the rest of them were, and Magneto, he was just making the premise of, you're not going to be discriminated here. This is just us against the humans. This is our survival period. End.
Well, and they tried to do it, but it was so subtle it may have been missed, or may have been not enough that was, like you said, believable. Whenever, you know, he kept hinting, you know, you're beautiful the way you are. Magneto referring to Eric, who's saying, you know, you shouldn't have to hide and that stuff. And she started to emulate some of the same statements. But it didn't seem like it seemed like it was happening so unnaturally. Like
it was rather subtle.
Yeah, it was so subtle that it didn't seem like it should be appropriate for her to be
Lean that way.
Yeah, and starting to believe that way, yeah. And stuff so quickly. But it may be that the movie didn't give you a good judge on how long they trained at the facility.
It's got to be less than a couple of weeks, right? Because they'd been training a little bit beforehand, but they're sitting at the TV, and Kennedy gives the speech on if they cross the trade line, that's a declaration of war. And I think it even says in either Kennedy says it on the TV or Charles says, okay, we've got a week, 2 weeks. It's not long. It's
well,
not like they're
no,
sitting there for
Eric, months. Eric says, get your sleep because we got to be there in the morning.
Yeah.
At that point.
Right.
Whenever he says that they're on their way to Cuba and stuff. Mm-hmm. It just makes me wonder, you know, at what point did they get to Charles's house, his mansion in New York, and what time, and when was the, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis? How long were they, you know, those screens that it does where, you know, it gives the montage of what everybody's doing during that time.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't linear. And mm-hmm. It makes you wonder, you know, how long did it take for Summers to be able to use the vest? How long did it take Beast to develop the vest?
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about that. I mean, as smart as Beast was, he's not building that circular thing in a day.
Like, and he's not doing it ahead of time, you know?
Yeah. Hope I meet a mutant that can shoot this weird thing out of his body. Because boy, would this be handy if we did? Like,
well, see, and that goes to Cerebro. That was kind of convenient. I know that it was explaining an origin, but it did seem kind of forced.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden, oh, they've got Cerebro. They're just waiting for a telepath that's strong enough to use this machine.
Yeah. I also the thing that was somewhat interesting is, and I understand why they did it, especially with having him being the most relatable person to the Raven character, Beast is the one freaking out over the way he looks, and he's just, if you wear shoes, you're good, dude. Like, just never wear flip-flops, and you are fine. You be that weird dude who wears socks with his sandals. Everybody's going to judge you a little bit, but that's fine. He's just like, I look so weird. I just look so crazy. I'm just like,
you got
Hobbit, dude. That's it. Like, that's all you got.
And I have to admit some ignorance here. I'm not sure. You know, when you go back and look at the X-Men history, you've got Beast not blue and hairy.
Right.
And you've got Beast blue and hairy. Was there a point where it explains his change, or was it just two different eras?
Now, I, once again, I'm not sure. much more a DC guy by default than I am Marvel, especially something that has so many characters.
See, I'm claiming ignorance. I mean,
I will say, based on the comics I read this week, which was only, you know, four comics, it takes place in two different times. It does flashbacks, and he isn't blue in the older flashback. I don't remember off the top of my head if he's even in the newer ones, the newer flashups, but in the original, like, this is when what's going on back then, because it keeps going from now to then. In the then time, he does look like a dude. He has skin, hair on the top of his head, not blue. At least some point, they reference him as being a normal looking dude.
Okay, that reason I asked that is because it might explain why they decided to make him that way. Because, you know, when I first saw Beast, it's back when I was a child, and the first time I saw him, he was blue and hairy, and he was a beast. And then I saw a comic book from an older era, which it showed all of them in their older costumes, and in their older costumes, he was not. He was just a big guy.
Right.
And I didn't even realize it was Beast until I read the thing. And it made me, I don't know if it was just because they were different eras, because, you know, everybody's story gets retconned and things like that, yep, depending on, you know, which era in comics it is. But I didn't know if maybe that was why they decided to show his transformation in the movie, because I'm with you. I never understood what his big hang-up was. They made, especially if you've watched Beast or you've seen Beast later in his life, whether in comics, animation, or in the movie, they had Kelsey Grammer in X-Men 3, mm-hmm, the most appropriate casting choice, in my opinion.
Oh, for sure.
You don't know how he got from being what he was in X-Men First Class to being that, so sophisticated and intelligent. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think maybe, the more I think about this, maybe one of the reasons that it doesn't seem like such a big deal to me, maybe even to us, is, I mean, we're sitting here and we are mid-20s, white, middle class, and we have been all of our life. Like, there really is no giant... We fit into culture. Like there's not anything about me that doesn't really fit in. I mean, yeah, we all have certain things. Our feet are hairy. We talk with a real southern drawl. There is those little things. And honestly, it is weird, because that even that small thing about you, when you can be compared to someone else in the world, so much a part of the norm, you can feel so out of place by that one little thing. You know what I mean? Okay. Like, when you're 13, voice is squeaking every other word. For all of who you are, you're pretty much still normal looking, but that one thing makes you so self-conscious.
I like to think of myself a little bit more independent than that, but I'm sure that I went through that as well.
In sixth grade, you were talking about as far as like the accents and stuff go. Sixth grade, I hated everybody that I went to school with, pretty much. Because, let's face it, I got made fun of a decent amount. Even my teachers made fun of me. Particularly for how slow I talked. Imagine that.
Is that what they made fun of you for?
Shut up.
And not your nickname, man.
I got made fun of, yeah. Possum. That's all you need to know. End of conversation. Possum.
Yeah.
Done.
Fair enough.
But it's just one of those things, like, maybe that's one of the reasons why, looking at it, just kind of thinking through it now, like, because these kids, this is happening to them. Outside of Xavier and Magneto, this is all happening to these kids around puberty time. Like,
or shortly thereafter.
Yeah, or shortly thereafter. Ages, and you can definitely see that homage, you know, this kind of X-Men idea is one of fitting in. It's one of when you're not considered part of the norm, even if it's something good, you know? I mean, some of these powers are fantastic. Like, I mean, Raven, although she seems very uncomfortable somewhat in her own skin, that is an awesome ability to have. Are you telling me, like I would never have to buy clothes again? Like, you just slim down to whatever you got to be, or big up. I mean, just whatever. Just hand-me-downs. That's all you'd ever need to wear.
Or you can make your own disguise from your skin.
So you don't even need it.
Yeah. Ta-da! Everybody's like, clothes. Why is he wearing clothes? Does she not remember that she just makes her own clothes?
I think we all were kind of...
All right, so like a little bit of a gap on that. But she... her ability is unreal awesome. Like, it's something that if you aren't having to live with it and you're not 14 going through this, you're like, that's cool. But I can also see it being something extremely... extremely hard, extremely difficult. So every week or every month, really, what we're trying to do is we're going to, you know, watch a video, watch a movie, rather, and just really talk about it, just the stuff we liked, stuff we didn't like, as far as the movie. And so that's kind of like what we were doing with X-Men First Class. We're also going to each read a comic, help us kind of diversify in what we want to enjoy this month in comics. I mean, let's face it, there are hundreds of characters that we could all dive into, and so each month we kind of want to pick something. So I think, Isaac, what did you end up reading this month?
I read The Death of Superman.
Nice. What are your overall thoughts on Death of Superman? Because this is like, you're not normally a comic book guy for, I mean, Isaac's not really a comic book guy. He's very much a jack of all trades, and we were just like, hey, you want to do this with us? And he jumped in, like, just dove right into it. And so you're not
even
really...
I think he found he could swim, too.
Yeah, oh, fantastic. Like,
oh, like 2 days after that, I went down and bought a... I think the official title is Batman Unwrapped, Court of Owls, graphic novel.
Oh, that's...
Well,
okay.
No, I take that back. Let me rephrase that. Even more cool, my girlfriend bought it after we had been together for a year.
Yeah.
Just straight up, like, yeah, I'm getting this for you.
Caper.
Here you go.
Yeah.
Caper.
So, jumping in, because Death of Superman, definitely iconic. I mean, events in comic book history, got to be top 10. So, what'd you think? What'd you think of it?
First of all, I think all of us have read that, right? I just wanted
to
make sure.
Yeah, I know I have.
You have, and now you have, I have. Okay.
I liked it quite a bit. I mean... Just to be straight with you, my first comic book experience was The Watchmen, the graphic novel, and I was just, nope.
Which was a debate for a much later time, but okay.
Agreed. The storyline, it was honestly, as far as reading, like delving into comic books, basically wholeheartedly, it was a lot more poetic and a lot more metaphorical than I ever even dreamed comics would be, period. And I honestly don't know, just because of lack of experience, if Superman is always like this, but I really enjoyed the metaphorical sense and the poetry throughout the comic the entire time. And that was actually one of the more intriguing points that I found. Superman, even if you know very little to nothing about him, he came from Krypton, raised by parents that was basically secluded.
Kind of country, wasn't
it? Just a smidgen. Very simple origins. Kind of humbled nature, like be chill, care about others first.
Homegrown values, kind of.
Good word. And like you see pretty much all throughout this particular graphic novel, that Superman, he's basically using his experiences and what he's been taught by his parents. This is all about everybody else. This is all about the safety of these people. This is all about me saving them. This is my purpose. This is what I got to do, and I'm going to do it.
Almost, you can chop up. You can make the argument that a lot of what Superman does can be seen that as, even though he would never say it's self-glorifying, it's always for that person he's saving, it can come across self-glorifying. Like, he's flying in the air, he's wearing red and blue, like, he's kind of not the most flashy of superheroes, but he's a pretty flashy dude.
Well,
and he's got this huge strength that he displays. And this is one of the few times, or not the few times, but... It's an act that does not leave him in any way, and he knows this pretty early on. This is not going to end in him any way getting any good out of this. This is all for everyone else. It's his ultimate selfless act, almost.
I'm a little tainted with this one because when I first read it, I actually read a Reader Digest version almost. It didn't have the Justice League involved. It was very focused. It was a novel. That was based on the graphic novel. It was written, because I read it much younger, and the novel that I read, it cut out a lot of the extra stuff that is not tied directly to the storyline, a lot of the Batman stuff, a lot of anybody beyond Superman and the super beings spawned from him after his death
right.
are not included, which was unique.
yeah,
for the most part. The funeral scene was mainly is the biggest part in that novel that had any extra characters. And then afterwards, when I got a little older, I went back and actually read the graphic novel, and I actually had an edition of the funeral.
Oh wow!
I've got it somewhere. The full page or full book spread of the funeral procession is very nice. I get a little tainted because I feel like the graphic novel has so much extra stuff and so much more to offer, but it's not necessarily necessary.
So you're not a huge fan of the... like, if you're reading it, you feel like a lot of the graphic novel's filler, huh?
I do.
Really?
I'm tainted.
I mean, like, it's probably been years since I read this one. Isaac, what are your thoughts on... Did it feel like filler to you? As someone, this being the first time they're exposed to really this story. Because
whenever I read it, there was no Lantern Corps involved. Which, you think about the fight for Doomsday... there was a lot of people involved in that.
Yeah.
And in mine, there was Supergirl and Superman.
Well, in this particular one, like, Supergirl comes in, like, halfway through the...
Right.
Through the novel. I could see it as being filler, possibly, because, like, the first half of it is basically...
I probably committed sacrilege, and everybody who loves Superman and loves Death of Superman is probably thinking, I'm ridiculous thinking that.
Yeah. That's why I'm wondering, because the thing is, I feel super bad about
I'm being awfully bold with that.
I feel super bad in saying that it's not filler, but I also can't point to go, and this is why, because of this scene.
There's not a character that exists outside of the Superman, I keep saying that, that's necessary for the beginning, middle, or end of the story.
Yeah, that may be true.
The only one...
There's not another character that's necessary.
There's not any
outside of Superman.
In terms of superheroes, that's in referring to anybody that's not with a Superman type name or relation.
Gotcha.
Like the Lanterns, anybody in the Justice League, they're not necessary for the story.
Gotcha.
Which is funny as a moment of just every time you get into a comic book, you've got to just strip off some of reality to get into it, or honestly probably look more deeper into reality. But the one thing that is funny looking back is the Justice League is totally established by now. It's definitely in full force. And they're like, I think Superman's getting his butt beat. You want to step in? Nah, he's got it. Like, of all the times that you need the Justice League, this is the one that kills Superman.
They had the blue beetle
that we need. Yeah.
If I was
that's how they killed him off. You're like, it's like you didn't even help. You're just in the way.
I was Superman, when I came back and said, I'm done.
Yeah, I'm out.
Yeah.
Peace out.
Really, all the time. I got your back.
Agreed.
Once again, the selfless nature of Superman right there.
Yeah, seriously. He says, once again, I've cleaned up a mess.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I loved, one of the greatest things about comics is it's not just good. Comics aren't just good stories, they're good art. I love the weariness, the looks of weariness on Superman in this graphic novel. You don't get to see that a lot with Superman. Not a good Superman story isn't one where he's always just the titan of strength, but very few give him the weariness that this Doomsday fight does.
And it gives him a little bit of humanity.
Well, see, and yeah. Superman has always been hard to relate to for humans, and that's why he's fallen out of favor in common society now. I mean, popular culture,
right.
Because they see him as unbeatable, Boy Scout, you know, what can you
when
do against him?
Christopher Nolan can make Batman so human-like, the idea of Superman is just totally...
Right, it's a little too far beyond us. Mm-hmm. And especially somebody who's so self-sacrificing, he would have to be alien.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's that kind of thing is hard enough. And for, like you said, whenever you see that, and that's where I think I lacked in the novel that I read before I read the graphic novel. They had a few pictures every chapter, but then most of it was text. So I got a lot of this described to me in text format. So I missed out on a lot of that. And that was one of the good things about reading the graphic novel, that it was able to bring to the table.
Oh, and I love the pictures. The cover, at least of the version I have, the compounded edition, it's not all of the single issues. The cover of the Superman, the tattered Superman cape, on this debris, just kind of flowing in the wind, like it's very much, you know, this is a series.
Iconic.
As a Superman. Yeah, it's very iconic. It's very much just this beaten down idea of Superman.
Agreed. I liked it quite a bit.
So my read this month was, I tried to jump into something totally new. Like I said, I'm more of a DC guy. I jumped into X-Men and I read it's called the First to Last Story Arch. It ran in 2010, and it covered issues 12 through 15, written by Chris Yost, and did art by Ed McGinnis and his team. But this was a really interesting read, especially since I haven't been a big X-Men guy. And so really the whole story is there's these evolutionaries is what they're called, and they're almost like right in the evolution of man, right after Neanderthal, or right at the tip of Neanderthal and starting to become Homo sapien. These almost Green Lantern-like people kind of scoop a couple of them up and kind of give them this ability to go throughout time, and their job is to see the next stage of evolution as it's occurring and make sure that if it's for the betterment of the universe, of that world, that species moves on. And so they come to the X-Men really early on in their formation, and they're like, hey, we want to help you evolve, and to do that, we need to extinct humans. We need to get rid of Homo sapiens. They call the mutants Homo superior. And so they're like, we need to do this. They kind of battle them a little bit. And the mutants at the time aren't willing to take the steps that the evolutionaries feel like is necessary to do that. So they say they'll come back. And so the whole storyline, those four comics, take place jumping back and forth between what's considered now, where the Storyman, the X-Men comic runs, and kind of what would happen in the very beginning of X-Men comics, that kind of 1960s era when Stan Lee kind of first started writing them. It was really interesting. The thing that was just kind of jumped back and forth to me is the continual flashback effect. And that kind of idea in storytelling in general. It's kind of hard for me to get into the X-Men characters just because I don't know them that well and I'm not as immersed into them as I want to be. But this idea of jumping backwards and forward in a story, that seems to become the new hip thing. I mean, Quentin Tarantino is like known for the fact that he just took a movie, chopped it up, and threw it around. Like,
well, I'm kind of at a disadvantage. I haven't read this particular...
I haven't either.
But I'm going to probably ask you a bunch of questions more than anything.
Yeah.
You're right, though. It does seem to be in style or posh at the moment to do that kind of thing. Not only with storytelling like that, with graphic novels, but also with movies.
Yeah.
You're seeing a lot more of that where they start you off in the middle of the action to hook you.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to go back and tell what's happened before. Yeah.
Give you a backstory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of movies are doing that nowadays.
Games and like everything is doing it now.
Yeah, like we were talking about this a little before we got on, like Assassin's Creed. Like that's exactly what I mean. It's a flashback.
It's constantly flashing.
That's all it is for the most part. Is they're looking back through history,
the backstory to fill the Assassin's Creed.
Yeah,
but I wonder what makes that so cool, so desirable. So neat.
Well, tell me this: when you started reading it, was it into at the beginning of it? Was it in a high action point in the story?
Not really. Like that's the thing is it starts off
because yours that's a fairly new comic, isn't it?
Yeah, these came out like 4 years ago when they relaunched. Not relaunched, but when they.
That Superman was 1992.
93 somewhere?
Yeah. 92. Early 90s. And then yours is within this decade.
Yeah.
Where neither one of ours is that way. And right now in our time, that's where what kind of storytelling we're seeing is that kind of... Even if it's just at the beginning. They start off in the middle of wherever they are, then they go back and tell you how they got there, and then they continue on.
Yeah. This one doesn't start off... I mean, it somewhat does start off action-y. I will admit, this was the first X-Men that I jumped into, so I don't know if you catch up with it too much. If you've read issue 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 11, and then you jump into 12, it just takes off. I looked through 11, and it didn't seem like it done that, but... It doesn't start off really too action-y. The one thing that I was wondering is, did they need to? This is coming out in 2010. Our movie X-Men First Class, which was highly anticipated to come out less than a year later. So they're definitely riding the X-Men bump from the first three movies. I mean, if a studio is willing to spend $150 million, which is what they spent on X-Men First Class, they're expecting there to be some publicity before this hits. Like, they're expecting to ride a wave.
Well, and then after the movie, I'm just thinking back whenever the first three X-Men movies came out, and then they had the X-Men Origins come out for Wolverine, and I'd read somewhere that they had at one point thought about doing a Magneto origin story, and a lot of they revamped the animated stuff as well. They came out with like three or four different X-Men versions to put out, and then if you watch the Greatest Thing on Earth, Netflix, they cater to that kind of stuff as well. Whatever's come out, they show you everything that's old or new in regards to that.
Right.
When Days of Futures Past came out, they put the X-Men animated cartoon back on Netflix at one point, and it's been taken off since.
Right.
But they do a lot of that because it's catering to like you said, they ride the wave.
Yeah. Like I said, the
makes you wonder if the linear thing is not some kind of a wave that people are riding.
The bouncing back and forth?
Mm-hmm.
It would seem so.
I could see it.
I mean, because it goes beyond just superhero movies or even comic books. You see it in other genres as well.
Yeah. And the better it's done, the more interesting everybody finds it. The biggest ones that I keep jumping back to, Pulp Fiction is always this iconic, which I do not
enjoy.
Well,
if you think about we say it's new, and it seems like a lot of things are doing that, but you can go back 20 years and 30 years and see, I'm thinking even older than I am, there's some of the most iconic movies do that. Anybody ever heard of Star Wars? Star Wars starts at episode 4.
That's true. They do kind of, but they don't flash back. That's the thing, though.
Oh, okay.
It's one thing to start in the middle, which has been, that's always somewhat been an idea of stories. Instead of giving everybody a full, detailed background, you start them off interesting and you just go interesting.
Okay.
More interesting.
No, there's a couple of old westerns that I have that are like that. I
know y'all don't know what about that. and this goes, this has a small tie into X-Men because Hugh Jackman was in it. Swordfish did that.
Yeah.
Swordfish did that from the get-go. And a lot of people don't like that movie or can't follow that movie. I love that movie, by the way.
Yeah,
I think it's a great movie. And there's things about it that aren't great, but it's a good movie, in my opinion. Yeah.
One of them, another one that's really popular and does it in a different way, not real popular, I guess it's just kind of a kitsch thing, Memento by Christopher Nolan, the guy who done the Dark Knight trilogy. One of his first movies is a dude can't remember past like 15 minutes, and so the whole thing starts at the end, and you see the first 15 minutes, or maybe it's like half hour that he can remember, and then of course he blacks, and then you jump the next 30 minutes that he remembered before he blacked again, and it continually jumps backwards 30 minute intervals, and it's really crazy, very interesting, because the whole time you know what's happening. And it's a very crazy, awesome story. But the whole time you're like, is that really what happened? Because it's just such a different way of telling a story.
You're going to have to tell me if yours does this. But I think that a common theme amongst telling stories and stuff, in a way to try to engage the audience to personalize or to, relate to the main character. A lot of times their memories and telling it in a way that they're remembering stuff.
Right.
And the way that humans tend to remember things, that might be a way of gaining an audience or a relatability with a character. I don't know if your comic did that, but maybe that's what they're trying to do nowadays.
You know, I'm really not sure. Like, I think it...
Is there a person or a character that it centers around, or...?
Mostly the evolutionaries, these kind of guys, because you don't quite grasp what they're doing. Like, you know what they're doing, but you have no real ties to them. So it almost wants to anchor you in with them. Cyclops is probably the biggest...
he's probably one of the constants.
Yeah, him and Magneto are the biggest X-Men that flow in this story. Definitely features those two as your key guys. But
they couldn't pick two people that were more different.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the crazy thing is, toward the... And the earlier flashbacks, you know, it goes toward this idea of, or Magneto is what you think of with Magneto, the Magneto from the animated series, where he is, I will rule with an iron fist as long as mutants are, appreciated. And then toward the end, he really sees that him doing that would make him what the humans are. If we frame it in the first class narrative, he sees that if he becomes what he wants to, he's going to be Shaw. He's going to be that guy.
The oppressor.
Yeah, somebody tormenting somebody else. It it's a
does
very,
he back off or does,
yeah, he doesn't do it, like, because the evolutionaries are pretty much like, if you give us the go ahead, if you'll be the leader, we'll wipe everybody else out. We just need you to pretty much nod your head, say yes.
That reminds me of a continuity that I read and I had several issues of, Age of Apocalypse, where Xavier is killed and Magneto is pretty much, Magneto and Wolverine are the ones leading the resistance against Apocalypse, who's pretty much taken over. I find that interesting, considering the newest X-Men movie is titled Age of Apocalypse.
Really, the new X-Men,
the one that they're, the next one, from what I read, what they're thinking for the next title is going to be the Age of Apocalypse.
Really, I've heard that rumored as Avengers 3 title as well. I don't know how true that is.
Really?
Yeah, because I mean, you know, they released the Ultron trailer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in doing so, they pretty much, like, this last week or two, Marvel's been like, whatever, spoilers, here we go. And so they've released like 16 of their next movie titles. Like, there's going to be a Doctor Strange and all this stuff. I know they said there's going to be an Avengers 3. I know that one for sure.
But right.
I thought the tentative title for it, or maybe it's just the rumor.
Was there
title.
Any crossovers to Avengers with X-Men?
I mean, comic book wise, there's a ton. But in comic
I mean,
books,
I mean, I've just not read many of them, I don't think.
In Marvel, everybody...
I know they all exist in the same universe,
right.
But you don't see a whole lot of mutants crossing over into the others. You see Spider-Man with... Spider-Man, I think, is probably the one that goes everywhere.
Right, that's what I'm thinking.
But you saw Spider-Man with the Avengers. You saw Spider-Man with Fantastic Four, but you don't see Avengers with Fantastic Four. You see Avengers with different groups, but you don't see a whole lot of the mutants mixing with that. At least not that I've read.
I'm pretty sure they do. I know... one of the things I was reading after I got done reading this, I was really trying to get into the X-Men, is the House of M series.
Oh, yeah.
They're very much across the Avengers.
I've heard of that, and I've looked it up,
really,
but I've not
really
got to read
check
it.
Check it out. When I was hearing mention of the new Avengers 3 and kind of what that could look like, because there's also going to be like a new Civil War revamp, is it would be almost... It'd be very hard, if not impossible, for them to get Spider-Man over, because the cinema copyrights to Spider-Man are either sold or leased out to Sony. And so everything that Spider-Man gets done, everything that goes with Spider-Man in cinema, has to be approved, written out by Sony. They're the company that kind of umbrella.
Did that happen after they revamped to the anime, the Amazing Spider-Man, or?
I really don't know. I just know that...
Was that in place when Tobey Maguire was playing?
I don't think so.
Oh.
But I could be wrong.
Okay.
But that's why no one... With all the superhero things that have happened since, you know, Iron Man 1 and the Hulk, which kind of started this whole Avengers tidal wave, Spider-Man's never even been hinted at. It's not even in any of the movies. It's not even like Spider-Man exists in their world. And I think that's
the thing that gets me, is even though we know that they do, and the movies have been bad to portray that, but comics have you know, they've crossed over. But it seems like even the ones that I've read, they're isolated fairly. Because think about it, New York, New York was where Avengers, yep, where Stark Tower was,
yep,
where Fantastic Four was.
Yep.
And it was Manchester. Am I thinking right? X-Men? Where was the mansion?
Yeah. It was in...
Westchester?
Yeah, Westchester.
So, I was thinking Manchester. Going a little far over the pond there,
yeah,
whatnot.
It's cool.
How does Xavier have a mansion? Thank you. A house in Winchester, and he's got this deep British accent.
Westchester. I did it too.
but he's got this British accent. But I'll just go back to the X-Men slide. I'm wondering if they're copyrighted out, if they're sold out. Because if you read or watch anything about Stan Lee and Marvel and kind of their rise to fame, to the equivalent of what DC is, they were always this comic book stuff, and then kind of Stan Lee and some of the people in Marvel and Eric were like, TV's going to be the thing. We got to start getting in on TV. And so they sent Stan Lee out west to LA and started doing Hollywood and stuff. And I wonder if Spider-Man, I know Spider-Man's kind of, like I said, he's kind of contracted out somewhat. I wonder if X-Men's in the same boat. You can't do anything with them cinematically, unless
it makes sense. I would, if I was Stan Lee, or if I was the people at Marvel that decided that kind of stuff, which I guess it's Disney now.
Yeah,
since Disney bought it, all the rights to Marvel Comics, I would departmentalize it. I would, just because you could make so many different movies and focus. I think that was one of the things about X-Men and reading the comics that makes it a hard read for some people, is the fact that there is, like you said, so many main characters.
Yeah.
And that's why they have so many different lines of comics. You've got the House of M, you've got Age of Apocalypse, you've got, you know, they came out with a Wolverine comic. They came out, I mean, they focus on one, and even the movie started doing that.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's a smart thing to do, even though it's frustrating for us who like to see them interact with each other. But I think it's financially it makes sense.
But at the same time, I wonder if you have these guys and you, the only reason they're not in the same movies or mentioned is because you say so. I would understand if you want to completely, if you don't want to make Spider-Man or X-Men part of your Avengers squad or nothing like that. But it seems to me like if you want to at least bump their sales in the movies, just have Tony Stark, just have Tony Stark run across Peter Parker sometime in New York and be like, "Hey kid, get off my, you know, my Rolls Royce or whatever," and you look and it's,
that would make a nice cameo.
You know what I mean? Because everybody'd be like, "That's Peter Parker." Like if he looked and, you know, somehow mentioned that he was Peter Parker or whatever, it'd be like, "Oh, they're going to do something Peter Parker-y." And people who are interested in not necessarily the Spider-Man storyline would be drawn in because there's something. Even if you never go any further with it, you would want to do that just to give that bump, you know? So that's why I think that it's not.
Back in the 60s and 70s, there was a cartoon version of Spider-Man. It was Spider-Man and his amazing friends with Iceman and Firestar. And there's an episode where they go to a science convention, and Tony Stark is presenting this new device that enhances robotic stuff. And Spider-Man has to save it from somebody that attacks it. And he says, he makes an offhanded comment to Tony that it's rough being a superhero. And Tony's like, "Really?" Mm-hmm. And then because they helped out, he gives them a lot of equipment, which they revamp their apartment. It's like an origin story of how the three of them got together, Firestar, Iceman, and Spider-Man. And then later on, they're trying to find this guy, and they think that maybe it turns out he's down at Stark Towers. And one of them makes the comment, "Where's Iron Man? Isn't he the one that usually defends this building?" And then Stan Lee gets on the thing and says, "Unknown to them, Iron Man, who is Tony Stark himself, is up doing a special job for the government." And shows him in space shooting meteors or something. It's kind of what you're saying, though. It's a cameo of
sorts.
Yeah,
it's a bump. It's just a simple, like, "Hey, why don't we promote this character?" But yeah, so I got to read that. I really enjoyed it. Really, probably the first time I've jumped into Marvel, and although I'm very much I like rules, I like orders kind of guy, and that's why I kind of like DC, Marvel isn't that at all. Everything's just free flow. I'm really digging it. I really like it.
And it changes from one thing to another.
Oh, yeah. But for all the silliness that was my comic, which was a very good comic, Dusty, I think you read V for Vendetta. The exact opposite of a feel-good, fluffy... it is definitely not.
Really?
So, what are your thoughts, V? I know this wasn't your first read of it.
No, you guys have both read *V for Vendetta*, haven't you?
I haven't.
Have you?
I've seen the movie.
Okay. I have to actually contribute, Andrew here. He's the one that got me started on *V for Vendetta*. It came out in 2000 as a movie in 2005, and it's actually the first movie I ever saw on IMAX. Thanks to Andrew.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. We saw it at the beach, didn't we? Yeah,
We went and saw it in IMAX, and it was wonderful.
But you know what's sad? The reason that we went and seen that was because it was done by the same guys who had done The Matrix, which I loved. And now looking back, I'm like, man, that is just a really
good That makes sense.
I was like, that's a real reason to go see a movie, because it was Matrix. Like, that was the special.
Well, it was a selling point for me, because I like The Matrix, and I thought, you know, That's surreal storytelling. Let's go see what it's about. And, you know, we're going to see an IMAX. It's bound to be good. And, oh, man, I loved it, the movie. And then I had to, of course, read the comic, so I ended up buying the comic. And this was a reread for me. But I did notice something that I didn't notice the first time I read it.
Gotcha.
One of the things that I like about this, and especially now when I read, I'm a little bit more educated, not only about the comic and... you know, V for Vendetta and everything, but I'm also more educated about history in general from when I read it. I'm thinking early in college, and now I've graduated and read more about the historical period in which it takes place. And the movie, of course, fast forwards that. It took place in, you know, it was written in the 80s, but it took place after that.
Right.
And the movie, you know, came out in 2005, but it takes place after that.
Right.
So a little bit, you have to kind of translate that whenever you're thinking about it. But one of the things that stood out to me when the second time I read it this time was the forwards by the authors.
Oh, wow. I don't even know if I've ever paid attention to
that. It's something, and it was actually the one, I'm thinking it's, let's see, which one, which author was it? You got David Lloyd and Alan Moore, and I'm pretty sure it is, yeah, it's the one by David Lloyd, and it says it was written in 14th January 1990. And he's talking about an instance before he started writing it, when he was in a pub, and it was after a long day, and he's in a pub, and everything's just kind of mediocre, and everybody's kind of, you know, going through motions of cheery but not cheery, just, you know, cheeky but not cheeky kind of things. And he's just talking about how everybody seems to be just going through the motions and have been lulled into a rut,
right,
so to speak. And if he wrote it, you know, if he's thinking this happened before he wrote the thing, it had an influence on his writing. And I think that's one of the things that I found really unique about V for Vendetta, is the fact that of the influence it had on the writing. And what's even more astounding is the same issues that it addresses in the comic that was written in the 80s about, you know, based on things that were happening in Britain in the 80s.
Right.
Was very applicable to things that are still happening in Britain and U.S. nowadays. More so in our country, because Britain was a little bit farther ahead of us, you know, a few years ahead of us in most things in terms of society and culture. One of the things, you know, I found it very fascinating is you could look back to the 80s was when it was written, and it's talking about things that have in the future, and the group that comes into power in V for Vendetta which it's mentioned, there's one little piece of dialogue in the movie that says the name, and I don't know if anybody has ever caught it, but it's mentioned a lot more in the graphic novel, is Norsefire,
right,
which is the group that comes to power, the conservative group. And it mentioned how there was a lot of different groups that were trying to come to power in the lieu of a vacuum of power after a war, and Norsefire was the one. And in the movie, they explained that a little differently. It was the one that came out with the drug and all that. And it was really well done in a way to make it a little faster and a little bit more. We're explaining it. We don't want to dwell on it. Let's move on.
Yeah.
But the book spends a lot of time on that. If you look back in the history of UK during the 1980s, that was what they call the Thatcher years. Mm-hmm. Margaret Thatcher, uber conservative, and you see. You know, you can very much see the author paying a lip service to the things that she's done and the things that the policies that were put in place or the opinions rather of the government at the time.
It is interesting how, if you think about it, it did come out in the 80s, came out from 82 to 85, 82, 89, around that area. That's right at the end of kind of the Cold War era. And you're thinking, okay, well, this isn't going to have an effect. And I mean, I bet if you're reading this in 85, you've just got done putting it down, you wait another 2-3 years and you're like, okay, well, it doesn't look like it's going to be like that. I'm sure this won't even be relevant in 30 years. You know, like that's got to be what you're thinking. You know, like now that we've got this Cold War stuff, Cold War, Smold War.
The Berlin Wall's fallen.
Yeah.
Communism's over. It's
progress,
it's gone.
Man. It's all progress from here on in. Like, that's just crazy how nothing new under the sun kind of mentality. You know what I mean? Like it's just all one big cycle. Like, it's just kind of this interesting thing. Alan Moore, which Isaac may disagree with me since he apparently hates Watchmen, which is just crazy to me.
Which is another
Alan Moore. Yeah, it's
partially because of inexperience. I'll go ahead and say that. Well, a lot of it's because of inexperience.
It is. I mean, it's like
it's not one to jump into. I'll just tell you that.
Gosh,
like, read something else first. I'll probably revisit it. And for making my earlier statement about it being miserably horrible, it was for being the first comic that I've ever read. And I apologize to anybody that
they're
going to
build up a mock-up of you, and somebody's going to have a voodoo doll because you've said that.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm horribly sorry. But I will revisit it. I will read it again. That is my solemn vow. As a matter of fact, if either one of them has it, I'll read it and discuss it the next time.
And he's country, so he makes a vow. He keeps to it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
it's just all of Alan Moore's stuff is just all the stuff he wrote in the 80s. Like,
oh, it's
what this
you can see. Well, don't you see parallels between Watchmen and the things that somebody could be thinking, as well as V for Vendetta, in terms of society?
Oh yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah.
So I mean, you can see how poor they just had a rough time.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. Like, it's just. I mean, if you look at the stuff he was writing, I mean, in the 80s, he wrote V for Vendetta, he wrote Swamp Thing, he wrote Watchmen, he wrote Batman the Killing Joke. I mean, he wrote just, in a decade, this one dude put out, like, three of the top 25, if not top 10 in comics. Like, this is a graphic novel. Like, this is just...
And they're not joyful or even funny in any context.
No, and as deep as these things are, like, you know these had to be over. Like, he had to be working on one while working on the other. Like, did anybody hug this dude in the 80s? Like I mean, did anybody love
Poor
him
guy.
At all? Like, it's just, you feel, like, I feel bad.
I think he felt numb. I mean, just going by what he wrote in the forward, it just seemed like everything was mediocrity in terms of the daily life of a Brit at that time. Because the way he describes what he went in the pub and he saw something on TV and the TV was the same and then the news came on and they turned it off. Because nobody wanted to hear that. They just wanted everything to go and be in a lull. They were comfortable in their lull. And that's exactly the characterization of society in the UK in V for Vendetta.
And it's funny too, like you were saying, like this lull... I would say you could make the case, maybe I'm over dramatizing this, not having grown up in the 80s. I feel like with all the big crazy nastiness that is in the world, you could make a case, I think.
You lived in where you lived, the 80s didn't get there till the 90s because you were so much in the country. So
yeah, <that's probably laughs>
whether you know it or not, you probably did live through a
nice.
But what I mean,
very
is
well
like,
worded.
In V and even in Watchmen, because they're both almost doomsday scenarios,
or at least or aftermath.
Or an aftermath, a recovery of. You're talking about, you know, being this lull. We're almost at the same point on the threat that everything could be wiped out. Like, I mean, we're talking 80s is really right after this Cold War end. You know, Reagan and tear down this wall, all this stuff.
Well, fast forward to when the movie came out.
Right.
Then you've got, you know, the War on Terror.
Yeah,
and then now, even if you're reading it now, you're thinking about ISIS or the things that are going on with the Ebola, especially if you watch the movie. You know, the fact that they had bio weapons and things like that, all that still speaks to the consciousness of humans or the everyday citizen today.
And because I mean, even granted, I don't think it did nearly as well. As
makes
the box
you wonder.
Office,
we had a rough last 50 years.
Well, for sure. I mean, it's been the bloodiest century in human history. How do we cope with it? We write graphic novels. Like, you know what I mean? Like.
Oh, it's been done. It's you know, before graphic novels, it was novels and
poetry. Storytelling, old school novels. Like, that's the whole
what
point
do you think
of storytelling.
Iliad was all about
exactly.
It should make people ask, make us ask, make me as an individual ask. Why do I read a story? Because you can do it for one of two reasons. You can do it because you're throwing up the blinder of what the world is in front of you. You can say, okay, I don't want to live in this world, so instead I'm going to live in this world where the kid with glasses turns out to be a wizard. Like that's the world I want to live in for the next 8 years, or whatever the case may
did
be.
Did you hear what he just
said? I love that series.
Hey, I did.
We've had many discussions.
Prisoner of Azkaban, and it is, I mean, Order of the Phoenix, and it is a thorough delight. Like,
I'm impressed.
Yeah,
I must
agreed.
Say.
But
just for a short backstory, we have killed Andrew for not reading any of the Harry Potters. I know that makes us wicked nerdy and whatnot, but we're talking about comics, so whatever.
It's okay, yeah.
But I think that, especially with V and this, it should make you ask why do we as a culture, humanity in general, why do we read stories? Stories are as ancient as humanity, really. And so, do we read it as a blinder? Do we throw it up and say, okay, I don't want to be in the real world, I want to be in this fictional world? Or do we use it, go to it, because we feel like that's where the world should be? Is it a mask from the pain we're in, or is it a call to that better world?
I think that I think it's all of the above. It's used as catharsis for a relief for when our world's bad. Think about, I mean, you know, in therapy, psychologists tell us to journal. They tell us to, you know, write down things. And let me just say this. It's not because I've been in therapy, but because I do therapy for a living. I know this. I just want to stress that right now. But we tell folks that, you know, journaling is helpful, that writing, expressing yourself, that's one of the first things you learn in therapy, or you teach. I keep saying learn like I've been in it, right? One of the first things we do in therapy is help someone understand how to express themselves. And that's exactly what I think graphic novels do. I think they also provide us with an escape. Like you're saying, a way to get out of ourselves, or even to predict. And that's one of the things that I feel like V for Vendetta was they were trying to think that if things go in these conservative times, it could possibly end up being just like this world he's created. Right. Now, we know that the UK didn't do that, but it very well could have.
I mean, like I said, I think anytime you read good literature, graphic novel, novel, anytime you enjoy art, the Mona Lisa of Van Gogh, or a really greatly illustrated graphic novel.
You're comparing
Van Gogh
I just want
Batman.
As much as I agree with him, I think that's a big jump. You're really making a jump there. I'm not saying you're not right, but a lot of people are going,
it's comparable.
You're comparing Mona Lisa to Batman?
Oh, come on. Highbrow.
Talk about me getting railed for Watchmen.
Yeah, this is his turn to get railed.
Mona Lisa sucks, no man. No, I'm just kidding.
I'd much rather see Batman or totally Superman.
Agreed.
Wonder Woman. That's it.
So, yes.
Mona Lisa is Wonder Woman.
I don't know about that.
Okay. We have derailed.
It should make us ask why. Because if all we're doing is using it to block out the real world, then what happens is that real world continually snowballs and snowballs and snowballs until the next thing you know, you need a dude in a Guy Fawkes mask to liberate you from the monotony, lull life you've put yourself in.
Well, like, that's why I think it can apply to all the things you'd mentioned. It can be a relief. It can be an escape. It can be an ideal. And I mean, think about Superman. I mean, that's exactly what he is.
Yeah.
That's what I was getting ready to say.
It goes back to Nietzsche, you know, the Uberman.
Right.
To me, it seems like as far as why they're written is just, a lot of it's just an expression of, like Dusty was saying, just an ideal of a principle. This is how we have this story. This is our example of what we go through in our daily lives. It's basically just an expression of exemplary humanity that can be for entertainment, it can be for catharsis, but more than anything, to me personally, it's just expressing an idealism that I, even like as in Superman, like going back to that whole discussion about his moral code and how he's completely self-sacrificing, like kind of like me aiming towards that kind of thing.
You know, as you read comics, there's a thousand different reasons why someone can get into them. Man, they're all so good. That's one of the great things about comics is there is something out there for everyone, whether it is super deep in depth and just rich like V or Watchmen, or whether it's just something somewhat sillier. Comics just kind of covers this whole big gap, and it's a beautiful thing. Thank you, Internet, for joining me and D and Possum as we just discuss kind of the things we like, the things we love, and graphic novels. Read something this week, read something this month, read something forever.
All right, guys, you have been listening to Country Style Comics, produced by Andrew Bowman, Isaac Hawks, and Dustin Jones. Special thanks go out to our lovely ladies, Felicia, Angela, and Sarah. Recorded by Bare Feet Beats, which is a division of SG Enterprises. SG Enterprises provides computer and network support, DJ services, as well as resume or cover letter writing and tutoring services. Look them up on Facebook, SG Enterprises. Country Style Comics is a CSC production. Thank you, guys.